had a letter last week, and it simply said, you spend too much time on the music going into the show, and I replied, and I said, you try to get five people in a room on time. But good morning, everybody. Welcome. It's a very nice day. It's Monday. It's the 7th of January. We welcome you all to the program, and it's lovely to have you here. Panel at WAMC.org if you would like to join us. Panel at WAMC.org doesn't mean you can come in and sit down and have a cup of coffee with us, but it does mean that you can write us a letter and share your thoughts about the topics that we are discussing. Let me introduce the panel to you. We have a good one today, a big group. We have Libby Post, political consultant of the Stars. Good morning, Libby.
Good morning, darling.
How are you? So good to see you. Sarah Rogerson is with us. She is the Albany Law School professor who also directs the Immigration Law Clinic. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
Wonderful. James Ketterer is here, Dean of International Studies at Bard College and Academic Director of the Bard Globalization and International Affairs Program. Boy, do we have questions for you, sir. Hi.
Hi, and I always like the music that starts the show, too.
Get you going. That's good. That's good. And Rosemary Armeo is with us, investigative journalist, and she might as well be sitting on the floor.
I know. These chairs are so low.
Yeah.
Not all of them. Just the one you're in.
Just the one I'm in? This is on purpose, Alan?
No, I don't think so. I think the explanation is that's a regular Joe chair, and he's a big guy.
This is a desk chair, and this is from the other room, and the desks are down much lower. Yes.
Right. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Well, I apologize for any false information.
That's okay. This is the intern chair, but I don't know. Mm. I just don't know. If we can, hopefully we can boost it up. If not, you can have this chair, and then I will be...
I'll sit on your lap.
Fine.
Oh, boy.
And then Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. Is that better? That's better. Yeah, there you go. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Joe, and what a panel we have today. What a bunch of great people.
It's an amazing
I really can't group. Interrupt today, or nobody is going to get a chance to talk. I have to be good.
We only got a couple letters.
Yeah, I know. I read them.
Yeah. I know. What was it, like 20, 30? It was fine.
David Soares kept mansplaining me. I had to.
Oh, yeah. You have to, then.
He did, yeah. It was awful.
And away we go. Good morning, everyone. Let's get to the topics at hand, and we'll start. There's a lot of different places we can start with, but I think we'll start with what the president has been. There seems to be some debate over the terms of national emergency. The president again says that he may declare a national emergency over the border. This will eventually get us into the discussion of the shutdown, which, as we know, is in its third week now and is tied to be the tied as the third longest shutdown in the history of our government. President Trump acknowledged Sunday that weekend shutdown talks led by his vice president would not break an impasse as newly empowered House Democrats plan to step up pressure on Trump and the Republican lawmakers to reopen the government. Heading to Camp David for staff meeting Sunday, Trump showed no signs of budging on his demand for a $5.6 billion wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, undercutting the staff-level talks. Trump declared that only he could make a deal with Democratic leaders in 20 minutes if they want to. Said Trump, if they want to, it's going to go on for a long time. With the partial shutdown in his third week, Nancy Pelosi said she intends to begin passing individual bills to reopen government agencies in the coming days, starting with the Treasury Department to ensure that people receive their tax refunds. That effort is designed to squeeze Senate Republicans, some of whom are growing increasingly anxious about the extended shutdown. And again, the president has thrown this out as a possibility that there could be what he referred to as a national emergency, and then got into very quickly by saying if you have a national emergency, then he could get the wall. And then we got into a strange definition, or at least it seemed odd, that he has told top aides to say that they wanted a steel barrier rather than the concrete wall that he had promised during the campaign. Trump said Democrats don't like concrete, so we'll give them steel.
Steel from where? That's what I want to know.
If he said all from the United States.
You know, where are we going to get all the steel from?
Well, we open those plants in Detroit.
Okay, fine.
That's what we'll do.
Okay.
There are a few thoughts that I have on this. One involves terminology. There is not a national emergency at the border. There is a humanitarian crisis, and the response is not concrete or steel. It's judges and asylum officers and potentially even more border security detail who have been trained to handle these types of situations. That's what we have. We have a national emergency in the Oval Office, and he is just trying his best
to drum this up. The resident of the Oval Office is the national emergency.
Exactly. And he keeps banging this drum, but it's not about a wall. We've talked about this last week, right? The funding would have to be, could be reallocated to other types of border security. There's a process. There's a budgeting process. None of that matters. This is about who we stand, what we stand for as Americans. And I'm get really frustrated when people say, well, if there's a deal for DACA, can't the Democrats come to the table? No, no. Billions of dollars. It's not about a wall. It's not about money. It's about the heart of this country and whether or not we still care about the rule of law, international law, and being doing the right thing. For asylum seekers and people fleeing to our country for all the reasons that we fight for it.
But I also think on the question of a national emergency, Bruce Ackerman from Yale Law School wrote a very good piece this weekend in the New York Times. And in it, he lays out why if the president were to proceed along these lines and to use the U.S. military, that they would be, he and the troops involved would be violating federal law. And he lays out the legal case, lays out the U.S. Constitution tradition, and then also brings up the time that Harry Truman tried to declare a national emergency and to nationalize the steel industry, and in a major U.S. Supreme Court decision that was struck down. So this is all flying in the face.
I'm the only one here old enough to remember that.
And Bruce Ackerman, perhaps.
I think Trump has been playing around with the limits of executive power for some time. Pardon was one, and now he's doing this. And he may well declare a national emergency. I hope he does, because, as you say, I think it'll end up in the courts, and he will not prevail there, as he has not prevailed for any number of his horrible policies, many of them involving immigrants and travel bans. So
are you sure?
I'm not sure, of course, because
he has a Republican Supreme Court now.
Sure, he has really changed. But they're all they fashion themselves as originalists, as constitutionally strong, and the Constitution does not support the president as a power on his own. It really does support a co-equal branch of government. So if they're true to what they say they are, which of course is up in the air, and the pattern continues that the courts are a check on Trump, this could be great.
Even on immigration, the executive power erosion has been happening for a long time.
Right.
Under the Republican leadership that wanted to return power to the states in order to cramp down on immigration at the state level, that pendulum has swung the other way. So we have all kinds of really interesting district court law precedent that's percolating. It's called the new immigration federalism. I think I've talked about it before, where it's the states taking back immigration in a progressive way. So that erodes this idea that the executive has such plenary power. And don't forget, we always have Congress could act to change immigration laws. It's still possible. It might not be, and it might not happen in this climate. But with the House where it is, I'd be really interested to see how they start to experiment with grabbing power back on immigration.
Anybody want to bet $10 on the fact that at least three Supreme Court judges will vote to do anything as incredible as it is that Trump asks?
Yeah.
I mean,
Gorsuch,
Alito,
and
Kavanaugh.
Scalito.
The saving grace
is
Roberts, which Thomas. Is so bizarre.
And what did you say?
Thomas.
Thomas, that's the first guy I would think of, who will do it. Yeah.
But what's interesting in all of this is when you look at the media, I mean, we know that the rational media has been calling Trump and the administration out on their lies, but Fox News is now starting to do that. And if he starts losing that media outlet and they start really pushing back, it will erode his ability to get anything done.
So, yeah, that clip of Chris Wallace pushing back on Sanders and this idea that there are 4,000 terrorists who have come across the border.
Right.
I'm really glad you mentioned that. The majority of those are individuals who were caught through our airports, ports of entry.
Yeah.
Not on
the border.
Well, that's the point that Wallace made. However, there's only one Wallace on Fox.
Yes.
And he, with some regularity, has been pretty tough in terms of maintaining his integrity.
Yeah. Scripps Howard had a column this week about Fox News, while the publicity is all on the Hannitys and Judy. Actually is filled with people like Chris Wallace, and their news department actually is going pretty much straight down the line now. It's not all Fox and Friends, and it is actually coming around to The View, same as the mainstream media, that Trump has some issues.
Or as Donald Trump always says, we'll see.
What I found fascinating when I used to be involved with the National Lesbian Gay Journalists Association was how many gay journalists work for Fox. And so that percolates up and it percolates down. And so you see the changes in the newsroom.
So then let's get to the actual shutdown and what brings it to an end, if anything. As we know, over the weekend, the president reiterated the fact that it could go on for years, months or years.
Once the toilets start backing up in the White House, then they'll...
That ain't gonna
happen.
Like
in the parks.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem. And then in the same breath, or at least half a breath later, says that, you know, he expects something to move fairly rapidly over the next week or so. I don't see any evidence of that, but I don't. Who knows?
No, the longest shutdown. I think Kamala Harris tweeted that the longest shutdown was 21 days,
3 weeks,
and we're on day 17.
Yes.
So. In about 4 days, the conversation will switch to longest shutdown in the history of the United States, and that increases pressure on the Senate Republicans.
And then how will our president react to that?
He doubles down under pressure.
Exactly. The way any narcissist reacts in the face of being cornered, and that is he'll blow up. He'll get more and more aggressive. We're actually going to rely on the Senate Republicans to come around on this one.
What I worry about is that Chuck Schumer will fold, as he has in the past. The pressure up to now has been non-existent because it was the holidays. Everything was shut down anyway. So while it's been almost 3 weeks, it hasn't felt like 3 weeks. It now will start to feel like that. And the longer a shutdown goes on, the more the public blames everybody. And Schumer has been susceptible to that in the past. Nancy Pelosi maybe will be there to give him some spine, but Democrats should not fold on this. This is far more than a wall. If he gets away with this, he'll do this every time he wants something.
I agree.
But I think if the Democrats start to or continue to redefine border security in this broader way, and maybe a way that makes sense, as Sarah was saying, that we need to have more immigration judges. We need to have all the kind of the things behind the system to actually process asylum cases, et cetera, that if that's part of the deal, I could see that being sold to the public in general.
It's interesting, though, Rosemary, Jim, Schumer doesn't have the power. She's got the power. In the end, she's got the majority, and what she says is going to go in that relationship. So he can bail if he wants to. It'll make him look weak. And I agree with you, Rosemary. He has not defined himself as being strong while this has all been going on and before. And I've so said. But I think in the end, it's all up to her.
All of the Democratic rumored presidential candidates are on the Senate Democrat side, too. So it's interesting. I wonder how that's influencing at least the Senate Democrats' stance on this. They have to be really, well, I wish they would all grow a spine on this one.
Yeah.
Especially on the issue of immigration.
I also worry that we're overemphasizing turnaround by Republicans in the Senate. It's Susan Collins, who's like wishy-washy at best.
Couldn't agree with you more.
You totally are right about her, Alan. And the guy from Colorado, who also is doing it for strictly political reasons. And there's not enough like him. There's not enough Colorado senators who are going to be under pressure from federal workers in their district. So I haven't seen that spine, that let's do it for the government thing from Republicans at all.
They don't believe in government. And you know, Trump has already said that all the workers are Democrats, so he doesn't care.
But he also said, I'm sorry, Joe, he also said yesterday, most unbelievable thing,
that they're all Trump supporters, that they support his nonsense.
Right.
They're making adjustments as needed. I love that.
and their landlords will understand.
Right, I mean, they're making adjustments as
fantasy land.
Living in a car.
Right, right.
It just seems, and I know, I apologize for being overly idealistic in what I'm about to say, but it just, I can't believe we're at this point, even almost 3 weeks into a shutdown, and we still haven't come up with a definition or a material for the wall. And it seems that even in the Democrats asking for an itemized list of, oh, okay, here's an idea. Why don't you tell us what the money is going to go for, that they can't answer that question.
It goes back to my original point. It's never been about a wall. It's right. about a win. Yeah. Yeah. He needs a win, and he needs a white supremacist win.
He needs to say we're going to keep America white.
And that's all that it's about. And that's why we can't fold on this one. That's why the Democrats have to – I think it's a failure of creating the right narrative around this. Let's talk about border solutions. Let's talk about what's really happening at the border. People are trying. And I think Mitch McConnell is feeling squeezed. I saw a couple of stories over the weekend where there are some grumblings. I'm not sure that adds up to a whole lot. I don't know if that's just a signal.
Grumblings to him or grumblings by him?
About him?
That he's feeling increasingly frustrated with the president.
Well, yeah.
On this issue in particular, and maybe it's that there might be some wiggle room there.
So the best analysis I heard this weekend was that the reason that McConnell has gone home to pick apples, as we used to say, is because the president won't keep his word to him. In other words, he works out a deal, and then the president seemingly is going to go along with it and then turns around, stabs him in the back. Mm-hmm. That could get him pretty angry. But he is going to run for Senate again, and he needs that Trump constituency.
That is the one good thing about this whole thing, is that Mitch McConnell is discomfited in any way because he has allowed this monster to grow and to thrive. And if Trump is like this, he has helped grow it. So good. I hope it comes back to bite him.
I wonder if that's why Ted Cruz introduced the idea of term limits for Congress members.
Congress members.
I was thinking, like, who does that impact? And Mitch McConnell is top of the list.
We have to go. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Sarah Rogerson, Libby Post, Rosemary Armeo, James Ketterer making up our panel. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We have a few, and Alan, we'll start with those now.
Okay. Thanks, Joe. Mike says on Fox News, everyone sure likes to give Fox News grief. Sure, they have Hannity, who is very pro-Trump, but Shepard and many other pundits are negative about Trump when it's called for. You don't see CNN or other media outlets with a level of fairness. CNN has reported negatively about Trump 99% of the time. In a Harvard study, it found the media extremely biased. I read them. I don't agree with them sometimes. Okay, so the wall, says Rich from Greenville. Is any part of this wall project shovel ready? Couldn't it be held up in court for longer than Donald J. Trump's administration exists? Write him a check and fight him in court. And Catherine says, Sarah is so right. I find it also frustrating how the administration continues to spout false information, such as so many thousands of terrorists and drugs breaching the open borders, which the Democrats are supposedly for, and being vague on the extent of what they really want, which is a wall of thousands of miles, some of which is private property. This also ignores, not surprisingly, the environmental impact, no matter what the dang wall is made of. And that's from Catherine.
But I think it's worth us thinking about, why is it that so many people continue to believe these pronouncements, even if they're proven false? What is going on in the country that allows a very healthy percentage of people to consistently believe these sorts of
things?
What
do you think?
I think that they're, a friend of mine, Tom Nichols, wrote a great book a couple years ago called The Death of Expertise. I think this is that what we see in people not believing whether they're terrorists coming across the border or not is a piece of that much larger issue where I think part of the problem is with experts. Experts have done a poor job of presenting themselves to the public. They've allowed themselves to be undermined, and it has led to this sort of situation where things can just be declared to be fake news or alternative facts or something like that.
So I think you take a look at the basic Trump support among Republicans. What is it? 30-40%. Those people, you could tell them Santa Claus is a communist and they would agree with it. No matter what happens, they're going to stick with it. It doesn't matter about expertise. They think it's all a bunch of junk. They are just sticking with the guy because he represents their view of how you make America great again. And we know it's racist, homophobic, and all the rest.
And then there's the evangelical part of this. We were having a conversation yesterday. I think somebody said there was an article in the Times recently. They're using Isaiah. And King Cyrus, I guess
King
it was.
Cyrus, right.
King Cyrus was an autocrat and a sort of a dictator, and he freed the Jews. And they always use Isaiah as a way of messianic comings. But that the evangelicals really see Trump as a modern-day King.
A miracle.
Yeah, a miracle and a modern-day King Cyrus. And it's okay that he's an autocrat and that he's dictatorial, because that's just the way it is, and that's how we stay a God-fearing country.
I think this syndrome predates Trump by many, many years, by decades. If you look at the anti-vaccine crowd as an example.
It's the dumbing down of America. Once we really stop teaching civics in classrooms, people don't know how government works. They have no idea what government is about anymore.
I think you're right. It predates even that. There's been an anti-intellectual strain in America since it was founded. The know-nothings as a badge of courage, that's ridiculous. And the idea that rugged individualism and common sense is what Americans have and we don't need the experts.
That's so true.
That's a dangerous idea. And I personally reject that by claiming, yes, I am an intellectual. I taught college, and you should try it too.
And
might change your point of view.
They're shunning higher ed, these folks.
Exactly.
They think education is dangerous.
See, that's all true, but I still think it goes back to the Civil War and who the supposed losers were. And I think many, not all, but many of those people are the same people who are racist, misogynist, and all of the other words that we use, and that this grows pretty well out of it. And when you see the red states and where they are,
that's right.
I think the theory holds up.
And they have the highest rates of people needing food stamps, and they're not going to get them now because of the shutdown.
I think there is a solid middle, though. The undecided voters, there are a number of people who didn't go to college who buy into the rugged individualism, but who read, because now we have literacy rates that are much higher. We have access to internet resources. I say this a lot, but when I go home to the Midwest and talk with some of my cousins, some of whom never, didn't proceed to college, but made their own companies or did their own thing, we have debates over libertarian idealism and all kinds of really interesting conversations. So that's happening, and maybe redefining what we mean by American rugged individualism should also mean well-read in one way, shape, or form. Maybe you didn't go to college.
My dad never went to college. He dropped out of high school at 16. He read the New York Times every day. He was one of the smartest guys
Mine too. Can tell you anything. You read five newspapers a day.
College degree is not the measure, but
reading,
right. Reading
literacy,
respect and admiration for knowledge. That's mm-hmm. what's missing.
Exactly.
That's what's made fun of, and you see that in the denigration of the press and of intellectuals. I mean, Neil Tyson. He's a brilliant man, and there's just glee that he's been brought down by a
Sorry. That's okay.
Just glee that he's been brought down. Like another expert who can be, that means all of his work is no good. It's awful. It's a very bad strain, and it's been in America for a long time.
And it's also fear.
It is.
9/11 left a deep scar on all of us. I remember it very vividly still now. And we had immigration reform right after 9/11 that was very anti-immigrant. That was exclusionary, that was focused on national security, and that's when the conversation changed from we're a nation of immigrants to immigrants are brown and bad, and they're here to hurt us. And, that narrative has been exploited ever since 9/11.
Especially by the parents of our parents, who were, in fact, immigrants. Everybody was an immigrant. And the very people who were the spawn of the immigrants are people who are yelling on the barricades right now, keep them out. Very, very hard to
get. It's very bizarre from that perspective.
Let's go to some more letters.
Okay, thanks, Joe. Karen says, IRS form shutdown. I've heard comments about tax refunds being delayed by the government shutdown. However, IRS dysfunction seems to go further. Looking at online tax forms at the end of December, I noticed that all the new forms and instructions are marked draft, with explicit directions not to file your tax returns with draft forms. So what are taxpayers supposed to do? Trump and his incompetent minions seem to have no clue at all about the ramifications of his current temper tantrum, endorsing extended shutdown of myriad government functions. This is just one example among many.
Anybody know?
Well, the one thing that we can assume is that if people's tax returns go in, and even if they don't, and you don't get your money back, there's going to be hell to pay. People will be very upset about that.
And it's his people that are going to be upset. What he's doing is also hurting his base. Well, they're going to get tax returns.
But I have not seen where, up to now, anybody turns in that group turns on this guy for any given reason.
No, he'll have his 30-35%.
Well, it's more like 40, and he hurt farmers with trade tariffs and protected them with the bill that we all are paying for. He's hurt manufacturers and coal miners, and they're still defending him because he's convinced them that they have to wait a little longer to make a short-term sacrifice for
and
a long-term
gain. He's convinced them that getting rid of brown people, anybody who's not white, is good for them and will give them their jobs back.
Jim says, I have a solution.
Okay.
Nancy Pelosi,
write it down.
Nancy Pelosi should go to the White House for a negotiating session. She should sit across from Trump and put her papers and pen and stuff on the table, and then unfold a large reproduction of a 1040 form and lay it on the table next to the Game of Thrones poster. Remember, he had one of those from the other day. And say, do you still want a wall? And that's Jim from Glenmont.
That's quite a visual.
It is quite a visual. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many other topics to discuss. We'll get to that and much more. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. We just received a fresh crop of letters. We will go through those, then we'll move on to some other stuff.
We'll go through them very quickly. I think people are so impressed with the breadth and width of our panel this morning that they're saying, well, I'd rather hear than...
They're in awe.
...than write. Yeah. You look puzzled, Rosemary.
No, I don't. I'm trying to see you through the maze of equipment.
Stuff, okay.
Right.
So Jill says, welcome back, Rosemary.
Thank you.
In regards to recent comments about anti-intellectualism, I couldn't possibly agree more. I was raised by two college professors, and I sense this also. Love your panel discussions. Keep up the good work. And that's Jill, who comes from the Schenectady Stockade. Could somebody just very briefly tell me what is meant by the word stockade?
It's the the Schenectady Stockade is the historic portion.
No, I knew that.
Oh, okay.
But is there something that keeps the water out or something?
No.
It's a fort.
No, it used to be, but no. People who live there routinely have to deal with flooding.
Best bluegrass song ever.
Stockade.
Columbus Stockade.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. You going to sing it for us now?
You want me to? I will.
Maybe during the break.
Oh, okay. Jesse says...
Time planning, good.
It's reading critically film... No. Let's start again. It's reading critically from multiple perspectives. It's all too easy to, quote, read absolute garbage online that simply reinforces your view. Critical thinking is absolutely essential when reading, and that's from Jesse.
Right, and we need to teach that much better than we do in schools before college, too. It's not a college-level skill.
Yeah, and I do think people need to get out of their comfort zone and read things that they might not agree with.
Yeah, that whole safe space in college thing, I hope you oppose. That's
and talk to people that they don't agree with.
Right.
Absolutely.
Mm. In your classes, when you get you're all professors, everybody in the room, in this room is teaching college. So my question to all of you is, when you get a guy who you violently disagree with, you know, who just says terrible things, raises a hand, says, my mother told me that every person who's on welfare gets a free television, a free computer, and a free telephone. What do you do? I mean, it's very difficult.
You're wrong.
You just say you're wrong?
Yeah.
I do. Or what do others think about that? Does anybody else have it? I was that guy. I was that guy in college. I went to Hillsdale College, a very conservative college. And I went into law school and was convinced that I was a right-wing Republican. And I became, here's a big admission, this might get me kicked out. I was president of the Federalist Society, I was encouraged to do that by my constitutional law professor, who said, you have far more nuanced views than you realize. Cool. If you really think that you are conservative, go ahead and start up the revive the chapter on campus and see. And that's the exact same thing that sent me running, because I was in Ted Olson's backyard for a reception of all the presidents of all the Federalist Societies across the country, and heard some conversations that deeply disturbed me as an American.
True.
And that was it. I got on the bus. I went back to my con law professor, and I said, you're right. And I joined Cory Booker's campaign for mayor and never looked back.
Smart professor.
So that's, I mean, professors can really alter someone's trajectory in terms of their thinking on things, and that was just rooted in where I came from. You take a young woman from the middle of nowhere Midwest, rural Midwest, and plunk her down in law school in Newark, New Jersey, and something's gonna happen. And for me, it was a very transformative experience, and I think we should all approach those conversations with care, because you never know what impact you can have.
And I think they should be conversations, too, that there's give and take, and that, Alan, if somebody says something outrageous like that, that there's a conversation in the classroom, that it's not just somebody else saying, well, that's wrong, full stop, but that there's a conversation about the issue, about the facts that have been presented. And I think it's our job to make sure that we've created a climate in the classroom that allows for those conversations.
As I was leaving academia, though, I was increasingly worried by monitoring of what went on, those conversations, that certain students were there to challenge professors and to report that there had been that kind of discussion. So that we, I think we're increasingly being encouraged not to have those conversations. I think it's a very scary time at universities. Academic freedom is not an absolute right. And there's a movement, I think, to make professors look bad.
I always loved the ones who got in my face. I always thought that was the greatest thing in the world. That was a real, those were always teaching moments, great teaching moments.
They should be.
Yeah, there are some of us, like me, I'm not dependent on my well-being teaching. And so, you know, I do one class every other semester. But I, you know, when somebody says something that's totally wrong, I will say to them, that's wrong, and look at the facts. You know, look it up. Don't depend on what your mother says, because your mother's not an expert in this.
Or go defend your position, bring it to class, and show us.
Show us. Where are the facts?
But I think that getting to that answer, the process by which you get to that answer, is more powerful, resonates more with the students if it's coming from their peers and not just from on high, from the front of the classroom.
That's right. That's always great. Okay, so Anthony writes, good morning, panel. Right off the bat, I want to say I do not want a wall. That said, I can't believe that no one in Washington would want to sneak the construction of this wall in an infrastructure bill that we desperately need. Where is the creativity of this administration?
Well, that means that they understand how government works. You know, there's that concept.
Yeah. Anyway, Allison says, steel wall. Dear High Panel, don't say this if someone already did, but it's likely that Trump the Builder has connections with steel people who would like this. Allison in Carmel.
I'm sure.
He's talked a lot about supporting the steel industry.
Well, but it all comes back to how much we don't know about this president. We don't know about those tax returns.
And what interests he has.
And I have a feeling that one will go all the way to the Supreme Court. It's so clear he doesn't ever want to let those tax returns out. Right. And you better believe that Jerry Nadler and some of these other guys are going to be doing all these investigations. The first thing they're going to ask for are those tax returns. Now, I can't believe that Mueller doesn't have them.
Yeah, I agree. I think he has them.
Because we've sent a lot of people to prison because they did bad on their tax returns. Yeah. Somebody had to see those criminals' tax returns in the past.
Yeah. I think it will take legislative action at the state or federal level to require candidates to show their tax returns. But they've never been exempt from criminal investigations. So why would Mueller not have them?
Right. You make a very interesting point there, Rosemary, about the state side of this.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that the state are launching all kinds of, and the new AG in the state is making making promises anyway that she's going to pursue an aggressive deal with the Trump or aggressive approach to Trump. So I can't believe we're not going to see what this is all about by the time it's over.
So in the 4 or 5 minutes we have before the top of the hour break, Nancy Pelosi was on Sunday morning on CBS yesterday. She tried to tamp down the concerns or the talk about impeachment she had talked about earlier in the week. She said Democrats are unlikely to pursue a path of impeachment without Republican backing. That could hinge significantly on whether Mueller's probe uncovers concrete evidence of wrongdoing. She said, quote, if and when the time comes for impeachment, it will have to be something that has such a crescendo in a bipartisan way.
Right.
Well, I think she's absolutely right. I wrote a column about that last week, and it's getting some people quite annoyed. Some of my more liberal friends who want him impeached by the House, which will go nowhere in the Senate.
Right.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense. And
time?
As I've said so many times, you only get one shot.
Yeah.
You know, you try to impeach the guy, it goes down in the Senate. You're not going to say the next day, well, we're going to impeach you again. Wait. Just wait. Hold your horses.
Right.
Then the other thing that I truly believe is we got a Democratic House of Representatives under a system where people are just frustrated and very angry. And I know that people reject politics as a rationale for proceeding. But, you know, in this
critical stage with Trump, we really do need to go after Trump in a way in which, if Mueller comes out with important stuff, then there should be investigations, and we'll get a Democratic Senate, and then you'll see a change.
Her remarks came amid days of Democratic infighting after a newly elected member of Congress from Michigan said, vowed at a progressive gathering on Thursday to impeach the mother blanker, referring to the President of the United States.
I like the sentiment, and I actually like the word a lot, too, although Joe tells me I can't use it on the radio.
No, please, you cannot.
Please don't.
I won't.
You just swoop in here, sit down,
and
drop
start swearing.
And then go get on a plane and go, and we don't see it for 8 months.
I told you, though, that my favorite tweet of the weekend was someone who said that women who dance, AOC, and curse, Representative Tlaib from Michigan, scare the hell out of the establishment because these are women who plainly don't care what men think of them. So I love that.
You're right. You're absolutely right. But and while I love the quote, there, you know, and I'm showing my age here, and I'm sure some people are gonna in the radio land's not gonna like this. There needs to be some respect for the institution that you have just been sworn into, which is the United States Congress, and there it's some decorum, and I think that ultimately, you know.
But isn't there a
she
difference from saying
bar.
It? Yeah, she isn't there a difference from saying it on the floor?
Wait, one at a time, because we're going to get 1,000 letters.
I understand that, but you know, it's
not
like
on the, not on the floor of Congress.
No,
versus...
yes, I know she was in a bar, but she is now a member of the United States House of Representatives, and there's a level of, from my point of view, there's a level of behavior that people should. Which the Republicans aren't doing, but we have to set the example. And saying that in that way just gives fodder to the other side, which we've already seen. And yes,
that's true.
You know, she can say, you know, they're scared of us, and they are. They are totally scared, the men. But
does it help?
Right. Does it help?
Does it help?
That's the question. Does it help?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I think I agree with you, but we can still embroider a pillow of it, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh,
okay,
for sure.
And I can sell it for you online.
Here's another thing, though. The impeachment of Bill Clinton, which was really kind of frivolous, has tempered this debate. He also should not have been impeached because there was no way it was going to get through the Senate. He had a lot of support, and because the charges were nothing like what we're seeing now. So that's and the Republicans were hurt politically for impeaching him. They really lost bad. So now Democrats are worried that if they impeach a president, the same will happen, even though in this case there are all kinds of reasons for impeachment. The New York Times made a very strong case for it. And there's also this other thing. It doesn't even have to be a crime. I agree that we need to wait for Mueller. But even if there is no crime, there's still enough to impeach him on. Richard Nixon, one of the articles of impeachment had to do with his using the IRS as a political weapon. That's not a crime. Mm-hmm. You don't go to jail for that, but it's a misdemeanor that the president can be held accountable for. His taking money from foreign governments, keeping his business intact, all of those are grounds for impeachment.
Talking about Trump now.
Right. Yeah. So the talk of impeaching Trump, completely legitimate.
Now I just want to say very quickly that Nixon, even having him resign the way that he did, faced with impeachment, has so energized many Republicans that it turns out that it has affected elections for years in advance. You have to be very careful with how much you want to energize. That's the way. The best way to do this is to have an election in 20 in which you throw the rascal out.
Well, I don't know if he's going to be there by then.
All right, we have to go to a break. Look at how well Ray's taking this. Very, very serene, very, yeah. we'll be back right after this. James Ketterer is Dean of International Studies at Bard College and Academic Director of the Bard Globalization and International Affairs Program. Investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo is here. Libby Post is a political consultant. Sarah Rogerson is Albany Law School professor who directs the Immigration Law Clinic. Alan Chartok is WAMC's own, and he has some letters for us, and we'll go to those right now.
I do, and Kate says, question to the panel. If wall-based border security is so essential and has nothing to do with racism, why isn't Trump interested in building a wall at the Canadian border? And that's from Kate.
I'm so glad she asked that question. In fact, because Roxham Road up in the, if any of you know where that is, it's on the northern border of New York and Canada, actually has quite a humanitarian crisis brewing up there as well, because there is a point and what we would call an unlawful point of entry where people are presenting themselves because from the United States to Canada because they've heard that Canadian asylum laws are more favorable, and they are. And we have people in the northern part of the state handing out scarves and hats and mittens to these folks as they're transported to this Roxham Road area. You've heard nothing about it. There's been one PBS documentary through WM, I forget what the Syracuse call letters are, you guys.
CNY.
Thank you. That covers that that stretch of our northern border. But also, I think, Libby, as you just mentioned under your breath, it's also...
Yeah, it's white people.
It's Canadian. Yeah, it's, they're quite happy and content.
Right.
Yeah, but think about it for a second. If, in fact, what Trump is saying has any validity at all, which it, in my opinion, does not, then you would think, well, all these terrible people are trying to get into the United States to corrupt our laws and everything else, right?
Right.
So if you think if they had half a brain, they would know there are lots of ways to get into this country. One way is through the southern entrance and one way is through the northern. But Trump doesn't say anything about the northern.
These people are trying to get out.
Yeah, well, anyway. A lot of people, right. You know. And the Canadians are very smart about who can come and who can't.
When it comes to Roxham Road, I will just a quick shout out to Pat Bradley, who did a really cool, very good story on this that you can hear online.
How would you get it? You go to WAMC.org?
WAMC.org and just put in Roxham Road or Pat Bradley and you'll see it.
Or both.
Thank you, Pat. I'm sorry I didn't mention that on the air.
No, that's fine. Okay. I just wanted to. Alan, I know you have letters, but I just want to quickly get to this one because it has a lot of words that I just want to say.
Are any of them mother, you know what?
I have to check. Richard is a dentist, and he said, "You all sound like a gaggle of arrogant, elitist morons, so erudite and learned. Haven't you grown tired of your myopic, subjective, biased, narrow-mindedness? It's outrageous you would assume that all of us who disagree with the progressive liberal ideology or movement are uneducated. There are countless scholars, scientists, professors, and academics who would call you out on with cogent arguments. Curious, have any of you read the Federalist Papers?"
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yes, I have.
Political science department.
I don't think any of us were saying that people who disagree with one point of view are by definition stupid. Uneducated. In fact, I was saying I think we need to find more opportunities for people to have conversations and bridge the gap of disagreement. And but I do appreciate being we're part of a gaggle of
elitists. Anyway, that letter kind of just like summarizes my whole point about Americans and anti-intellectualism, sums it all right up right there.
Could be, and all I can tell you is I've taught more than one course just relying completely on the Federalist Papers.
Yeah. And you know, that. And it's about people being nice to each other and having Simple. Some sense of civility. And returning back to civility. And, you know, would I want to have a conversation with this guy after he wrote the letter? Sort of, kind of, just to see. And I'll try to be
civil. Not if I'm in the dentist chair.
Yeah, not in the dentist chair. But you know, to try to have those conversations across party lines, to be civil, to find some common ground, is what we're missing. And in the White House, you know, he's setting the example for all of his followers, that you don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah, sounds like
your point about dentistry is extremely well taken, which is that as somebody is working on your teeth, then you really can't talk.
Right.
They can talk at you.
I think the lack of civility is not just from the White House. I mean, I think we see a lack of civility across the political spectrum, and we see plenty of people that are progressive and left who also,
yes,
I think, are highly intolerant
absolutely.
Of other points of view.
I think that, but I do think that since 2016, actually since the beginning of the last presidential election and the Republican primary and the way Trump behaved, really ratcheted it up. It gave people permission.
And just very quickly before we go back to letters with Alan, Ruth Bader Ginsburg has missed the first Supreme Court argument in her 25-year tenure after her cancer surgery. And that was this morning. The 85-year-old liberal justice underwent surgery for lung cancer last month and has been home recuperating, and also recently broke several ribs in a fall. And today was the day to go back, and she did miss those arguments. So there is that. Alan, go ahead. Boy.
Okay. This Tom says, whose America is it anyway? Billions of our, capital letters, our tax dollars to be spent on a project so heartless and mean-spirited. Most immigrants aren't leaving their homes because they want to. Right. How would we want to be treated if thrown into some of these horrible situations? Hey, if the shutdown goes on long enough, Mexico may want to build a wall to keep us out. Great job, panel. Love you all. Tom from Slingerlands.
Love you back.
Should have him meet the dentist.
And, yeah. Lynn says, and Lynn says, good show today. I'm so glad to listen to these topics today. Libby and Rosemary's discussion on literacy and the need of civic education was terrific. And sent from the Gmail.
Yes. Nice work.
Hey, anytime.
Good, you two. All right. So let's hone in on Syria and talk about that a little bit in the few minutes that we have left. The question is, will John Bolton put conditions on Syria withdrawal, suggesting a delay of months or years? So you'll recall, obviously, the president talked about a pullout.
Next week.
An immediate pullout. And now President Trump's National Security Advisor John Bolton rolled back on Sunday the decision to rapidly withdraw from Syria, laying out conditions for pullout that could leave American forces there for months or even years. Mr. Bolton, making a visit to Israel, told reporters that American forces would remain in Syria until the last remnants of the Islamic State were defeated, and Turkey provided guarantees that it would not strike Kurdish forces allied with the United States. He and other top White House advisors have led a behind-the-scenes effort to slow Mr. Trump's order and reassure allies, including Israel. This from the New York Times.
Interesting. Do you think that if the Turks attacked the Kurds, that the 2,000 Americans that are there would attack the Turks?
The Turkey, who is a NATO ally of ours, would we actually take up arms against our NATO ally?
Yes. So if we pulled them out, you see where I'm going with this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if we pull the 2,000, that's not a lot of people out of there.
It's the presence of the troops, though, that's preventing any kind of Turkish
action. Well, that's
my
point, yeah.
And as soon as they're gone, it's like giving permission to do it. Mm-hmm. And Turkey could make any agreement. Oh, sure, we won't touch them, And the day
Trump
after they're
it.
Out, they can say, oh, everything has changed because of whatever condition. And go on.
But I feel like a broken record when we come to these topics on this program, because I say the same thing over and over again. But whether it's 2,000 troops in Syria, 5,200 in Iraq, 14,000 in Afghanistan. Are we really in the position where we're just going to give carte blanche to any administration and allow these troops to stay there to put conditions on that really probably don't make a lot of sense? And whether it was George W. Bush, Barack Obama, or Donald Trump, this is a long-standing problem. And it really requires that the House of Representatives now hold serious hearings. 2,000 troops to do what? What is the policy? Is 2,000 troops enough to actually meet the goals of that policy or not? Are we carving out
a
safe zone for the Kurds in that part of Syria? If so, are we forsaking all the many other Syrians who have opposed this murderous regime? The Assad regime, are we just sort of throwing up our hands and saying, well, we'll leave that to the Russians and the Iranians? Is John and so there's that issue. I also think that we see here some insights into the fact that John Bolton and Secretary of State Pompeo are out of sync with the president. Now, that makes some people who don't like the president feel good and say, well, you know, the president doesn't know what he's talking about, so we can feel good about that. But that sets a very difficult precedent for people who are serving at the pleasure of the president to be promoting their own foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And their foreign policy, I think we should be clear, and we see Pompeo touring around other parts of the Middle East now, is to support regime change in Iran. And Pompeo, on this trip to pull together this coalition, this anti-Iranian coalition, while Bolton is dealing with the Syria issue, who, by the way, he was making the announcement of this from Jerusalem. So this, you know, and Bolton in particular is a real ideologue. Donald Trump, for all of his antics, is not an ideologue. He sees himself as a deal maker, as a transactional sort of guy. And so he would be willing to sit down and make all sorts of deals on Syria with Erdogan and Turkey. We can do this, we can do that. And that really bumps up against this ideological stance from the National Security Advisor, who is not in a position who should be making policy.
And Susan checks in along these lines and says to the panel, Syria, now that John Bolton has spoken, the warmongers can relax. War will continue.
Why would countries in like Syria and Erdogan and Netanyahu, why should they listen to Pompeo and to Bolton? I think it puts the negotiators in a bizarre position. They can say whatever they want, but Trump's going to do what he wants, and everyone knows that in the world. So that's one more problem. I think you have hit the nail exactly on the head. I'm not opposed to taking people. I don't think we should ever have been in Afghanistan. Why are we still there, you know, 13 years later? But to pull them
17
out.
17 years.
Yeah. Exactly. But to pull them out with a tweet after a discussion with Erdogan without talking with your generals, you begin to see what Mattis is doing. In fact, Bolton and Pompeo are now stepping into the role that Mattis and others played before they got fed up.
But we know that. And we've heard this song already, right? This has already been played out of if you go against the president, that there may be a momentary agreement, but then in 3 weeks or 6 months when those people are shown the door, that moment will be used as the excuse.
For sure, yeah. We have certainly seen evidence of that. But I think we also see longer-term evidence that if you go against the military establishment, if you go against the Pentagon, the uniformed military and the others there, if you go against the establishment, with Ben Rhodes, who worked for Obama, called the blob, that there are ways in which that establishment can box in a president. They boxed in President Obama on Afghanistan. And so they have boxed in Donald Trump. And I think that we see on the left and on the right some real resistance to that. It's an interesting thing to see play out in American politics now, because this isn't just a right-wing Trump base issue. And I think that, you know, my member of Congress, Congressman Tonko, and every member of Congress, no matter what their party is, they have a responsibility to say, we are now going to ask questions. I mean, Congress gave in 2001 an authorization for the use of military force that has been basically a blank check. It's been used in, I had to write this down, 41 instances in 18 countries since 2001. Oof. And how much are people really paying attention to this? And so I think it's important for members of Congress to step up and ask hard questions and play their constitutional role.
And I think progressive Democrats absolutely will, too. I mean, we have this pushback against the war economy. Movements like Drop the Mic, where you have people who served in the military who are now speaking out against the war economy and a lot of what those actions resulted in. And so it's a lot trickier to pin down the conversation nationally at home here, especially with the president and the military and the Secretary of State all in different places on the issue, when international relations relies on stable actors who have built up trust and can be counted on. It's scary.
I don't even know if Trump realizes that they've boxed him in. That's the problem here. Obama knew, because Obama understood. He understood the protocols. He understood how it all worked. He read. He educated himself. We don't have that in this president. So they can do all the boxing they want. But if he doesn't see it, and respect it or recognize that his powers have been limited. And then you talk about a military junta. I mean, you know, when you talk about what you just said about boxing him in, well, then how far are we from having a little military coup in this country?
Well, and Libby, what you say brings me great fear, because look at what's happened with the budget. There's been this huge buildup in the military at the same time that he's constricting, mm-hmm. he's bringing in the military. So how is the military being used? Is it to go to the southern border and string concertina wire? Is that what our military is for now? I think these are really serious issues, and it goes back to what you said. There's no policy. There's no discussion of a policy. There's no discussion of consequences. There's just tweets.
So the incoming, or he's now the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee,
right.
is Elliot Engel.
Right.
He's from our state.
Yes.
He has been the ranking member for a long time. He's got a highly professional staff. I think they're going to weigh in heavy on these sorts of issues. And their challenge, I think, is going to be picking a few that are the most crucial, because there's so many to go after.
Right.
And over the weekend, we have the Pentagon chief either resigned or was forced out.
The chief of staff.
The chief of staff.
Rear Admiral Kevin Sweeney. So the conflicting reports, which maybe by the end of the week we'll know for sure whether or not the White House forced that person out of their position or they resigned out of protest in this tension that we're talking about.
Even more important is Elliot Engel, I believe, was a Hunter College graduate.
Aha.
And you used to be, and he would always get into the State of the Union early and get a seat. So you always saw Elliot Engel on television. Always. I don't know if he's doing it now, but he always did it while Obama was president.
Yeah. We'll see soon.
Yes.
We will wrap up the conversation for today at this point. However, we'll be back tomorrow. We thank you very much for your letters. Thanks, everybody, for being here. Rosemary, Libby, Sarah, Jim, Alan, thank you very much.